of a big buildup.
She was wrapped up in this big buildup by the
airplane. Actually, all you have to say is what she said. My name is Ellen Cassidy, and I'm an enthusiastic, boundlessly grateful Al-Anon. I am so grateful that you've given up your nap to be here. And I'm hoping that you have given up your nap to be here and have not picked this place for your nap. I'm such a follower. If you start, you know, y'all will be able to tell if anyone out here starts snoring, because I'll be the one going, I am delighted to be here. This, I've never done quite the weekend I'm doing with you this weekend, which is very brief, 24 hours in Iowa, and I'm out of here. Yesterday I had this flight with a darling young man who sat next to me on the plane. Normally, my plane routine is, don't bother me. I have Sudoku to work. Or I have a book to read. Nice to see you. Keep a diesel. I mean it in a loving way, you know. This guy sat down to me next to me yesterday and he went, hi. And I went, oh, I love you. Bad time. Danger, Will Robinson. Danger. We had a delightful trip. I can't even tell you how long it took me to get here. It was a delightful trip. And, you know, it always starts off with, are you going home or are you going to visit friends? And I always say, going to visit friends, and hope they don't ask me who they are because I don't know, you know. And we got to the, you know, and as we talked along, of course, I bared my soul, as is my wont. And we were hugging and kissing by the time we got off the plane. That's the kind of relationship we built in that little plane yesterday. He said, so who's going to pick you up? I said, I have no idea. But I'm going to get in the car with them and just go wherever they take me. That's what I do. I got my name. Okay, that's enough. Let's go. I landed someplace one time, got off the plane, looking for the dog on the freeway look in somebody's eyes. You know, they're trying to figure out who I am. And there was a gal standing there holding this placard, and she'd back off, and she'd sit down, and she'd hold the placard, and I walk around. Pretty soon, everybody's left the airport except me and her. And I go over to her and I say, are you looking for me? She goes, yes. And I said, you're going to have to turn it around. She was holding the blank side out. It was like anonymity way over the top, you know. Anyway, darling girls were waiting to pick me up last night late at the airport. They were there to pick me up just as cheerful as they could possibly be. And I get here, and there are so many faces that I know and love. You know, gosh, Lyle and Christina. Ainsliff. I had a great time in Ainsliff a couple of months ago, and I'm just really glad to see them there. If you want to get some really good feeling, if you got some bad feeling, go hang around Lyle and Christine for a while. You'll feel great. I'm happy to be here, and I whoever did the bag with the food in it and the little gifts and everything else, it was way, 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 way cool. It's very packable, and it's stuff I want to pack and take home. So, thank you. I introduced myself as an Al-Anon. I always want to explain that. That's not good news or bad news. It's just the news. It actually is more bad news than good news, because explaining things to people is how I got to Al-Anon. You know, I always thought if you would listen long enough, then you'd understand why my way was the right way, and you'd want to do it, and we'd all be happy. One of the dichotomies of my recovery is that God now makes little nests of people all over the place, and he says, baby, explain your heart away. Today is your day in the barrel. Al-Anon isn't what I wanted to be when I grew up. What I wanted to be, I think, from my first breath was I wanted to be somebody's wife and somebody's mother, and I was going to be the best wife he ever had, and I was going to be the best mother those children ever had. It didn't occur to me until I'd been in Al-Anon several years that I had never wanted to be me. I had never wanted to be the best mother I could be or the best wife I could be. I always needed to be the best in somebody else's eyes. And it is an unattainable job to go for. But I ended up being with somebody's judge and somebody's juror and somebody's executioner, which is a line right straight out of the AA 12 and 12. And that is exactly what happened to me. And none of us were happy. We were all miserable. When I got to Al-Anon, I didn't want to be here, but I never wanted to be where I was. I always wanted to be someplace else with somebody else doing something else. As always, I could do more, better, different. I really get that. I've been in Al-Anon a little while, long enough to get some relief. I won't tell you I had any recovery, but I had a little relief. And I decided what I wanted to be was alcoholic. For one reason, it looked to me like alcoholic women had more fun than we did. And number two, apparently my husband preferred them. No judgments, I'm just reporting. I decided I wanted to be alcoholic. I didn't want to drink to be alcoholic. I had a number of reasons for that. And if you're an explainer, you always need your reasons in a row. Number one reason was I'd gone to some open AA meetings, and I was beginning to, it's always all about me. If you started talking about whatever dread disease you had, I was pretty sure I could find that twinge in me someplace, you know. And alcoholics started talking, I went, well, I think like that. I feel like that. I didn't get that part in the book where it says drinking is but a symptom, you know. See, I'm a person who doesn't think I'm just affected by alcoholism. I think I have alcoholism. What I don't have is the allergy to the liquid. I don't have that part. But you take that little part, because the drinking is but a symptom, and the rest of it is me. I got the same head, thinks the same way. And I enjoyed drinking. I enjoyed my two drinks. I never wanted more than two. Well, actually, occasionally I would think more than two might be interesting. And one time I actually had more than two. And I swore never to do it again, and never did. I still went through, I don't know why I'm telling this unless there's somebody here who must need this. I still went through these battles where from time to time I think I was alcoholic. And I think there was as much want to in there. Couldn't I just be alcoholic without drinking, you know? Just go to the big meetings with the big people, you know, on the other end. And one time I was talking to an alcoholic lady friend of mine, one of my absolute best friends in the world, and I confessed to her the thing that had really worried me for some time now, that I thought maybe I was alcoholic. And she asked me about this particular time span in my life. She said, remember when that was happening to you? She said, did you ever want to just go get drunk and blow the whole thing off? And I went, well, of course not. Who would stay home and take care of the baby? You know, if I did that, she went, you are so not alcoholic. Okay, I get it. Well, I wasn't sure, though, at that point, if I let myself drink everything I wanted, I wasn't sure that I wouldn't fall off the edge. And I didn't want to take that chance. And the other reason that I couldn't drink to be alcoholic was because I needed to be alcoholic that afternoon. And I really didn't have time to drink. So the solution I came up with for that problem is pretty much the same solution I always come up with in my dis-easiness. I think if you change how it looks on the outside, it changes how I feel on the inside. Sometimes I have to change how you look on the outside. Sometimes I have to change the way your children look. Sometimes I have to change the way you're performing your job. Sometimes I have to change the way I look. Sometimes I'll still tell myself, 10 pounds and you'd be perfect. You know, it's like my mother used to walk around and stick her finger in my back to make me stand up straight. And when I've been in Al-Anon some years, and I was like 40, in my 40s someplace, and she punched me in the back one more time to make me stand up straight. And I said, Mom, I hated that when I was 12. And I hate it even more now when I'm 42. And she said, oh, no, it's just that you're so close to perfect. If you just stand up straight, you'll be perfect. So like one of my alcoholic friends, he was, man, you lucky girl. I've never been that close to perfect. Anyway, change how it looks on the outside, change how it feels on the inside. So all I had to do was change how I look. All I had to do was look alcoholic. And I want to tell you that alcoholic women have saved my life. I am like a good many Al-Anons, I believe. I didn't come into this program surrendered. I came into this program looking for one more thing that might work. I didn't come in here looking for recovery. I came in here looking for relief. What happens is if you hang around long enough, life will give you the opportunity to surrender. And if you miss that one, it's okay. Because there's another one coming right behind it. Next one will be a little more painful, a little louder. But there's one right behind that one, too. You will get your opportunity to surrender. And my opportunity came. And when it came, it was the alcoholic women who saved me. It was the alcoholic women who said, I understand the black hole where you're living. And they were the ones who sent me to the big book again. back then in the third edition, it was 448 to 452, and she said, every day, for a month. I want you to read it every day for a month. And I said, yes, ma'am. And I did what she said. So having told you that alcoholic women, I don't believe I'd be alive today if alcoholic women had not taken time to spend time with me and love me. I will tell you that I came into Al-Anon on November 3rd of 1981, and I came in gorgeous North Dallas, sometimes known as gorgeous North Dallas, except if you live there. And my idea of alcoholic women was pretty skewed, sort of the Neiman Marcus approach to alcoholism, you know. So all I had to do was change clothes, and I had to put on skin-tight jeans and stiletto heels. And I'm thinking, I'm looking alcoholic. I'm looking alcoholic now. Yeah, I made a couple of discoveries in that little experiment. Number one, I didn't like anything to control me like those pants. And number two, I showed you, except I flashed her. Al-Anons are really doomed to sensible shoes. You know, we really are built for speed and not look. You know, if you love an alcoholic, you have got to be ready to go in a heartbeat, or you're going to lose him. And on those stiletto heels, you could kill yourself in the attempt, you know. Well, the place I did that little experiment was at the Crested Butte Mountain Conference with 600 of my closest friends. And this was the very first Crested Butte, which was 1984. And there were there at that conference four people who had between them 125 years of Al-Anon. And that many years ago, 125 years was a lot of Al-Anon. Elsa Chamberlain was there. Marcy White was there. Barbara Davis was there. Nancy Grennan was there. I not only got to hear their stories, I not only got to go to meetings with them, I got to have meals with them. Most importantly, I got to watch their interaction with their families. And I finally knew what it was I wanted to be when I grew up. I wanted to be free. I want that freedom that's offered me in step three, the freedom from the bondage of myself, the freedom to be who it is God would have me be. If it's somebody who can't complete a sentence today, you know, or somebody who's going to talk 80 minutes and have to be reminded by the paper to shut up, which is probably who you've got right now. When I came to Al-Anon, I didn't have very many opinions. Actually, the only opinions I had were yours or the opposite of yours, depending on what I wanted you to do. Today, I have very strong opinions. That's neither good nor bad. It's just different, and pretty much all I'm offered when I come here is a different way of life. Today, I have very strong opinions about people being called Al-Anon. If you want to watch the hair on my neck stand up, let me be in the room when some new drunk comes in the room, and the alcoholics say, oh, look, there's John, the alcoholic, and here is little Al-Anon wife, squishing his body. The only reason they're calling her Al-Anon is because she's squishing in behind John. She is not an Al-Anon, she's an alligator. Al-Anon is not a program for people who need it. Virgil talked about it this morning. Statistics are, for every alcoholic, there are 1 to 4 people profoundly affected. There are 10 to 42 people directly affected. Which means this meeting ought to be 10 to 42 times bigger than the meeting tonight. It is not a happening thing. As hard as it is, and it must be, to go to AA, I think it's harder to come to Al-Anon. It is darn near impossible to go in and ask for help when there's nothing the matter with you. I can always tell how many alcoholics are here. I had to come for a while before there was anything the matter with me. I mean, it was so obvious what the problem was, and it was not me, you know. As hard as it is to get here, it's harder to stay. You know, I have this picture in my head of what must happen when a new drunk goes to AA and they go, we're going to show you how you can put that down in one day at a time and never have to drink again and stay out of slippery places and stay away from slippery people and you can stay sober just like us. You come into Al-Anon and you want to start talking about it, which, you know, could be named George or whatever its name is, you know, and you want to talk about it, we're going, we can't talk about it. We don't talk about it in here. Oh, no. We're just talking about you, but no, we're talking about you. Every once in a while, somebody will tell a war story, and we'll go, yeah, you know, but at the end, we say, okay, go home and get in bed with it. Alcohol dogs don't have to sleep with it. You know, they're going to get out of there. You know, not us.
No.
And I don't know about you, but the most slippery place in my life would be my bed. That would be it. Hard as it is to get here, it's harder to stay. They say in the 12 and 12, yeah, 12 and 12, I think it's 6, that talks about this is the step that separates the sheep from the goats. The men from the boys. I don't know why that sets me so tickled me every time. Anyway, but the dividing step for us is really 3. You know, we're often accused of doing the Al-Anon waltz. We do 1, 2, 12, 1, 2, 12, 1, 2, 12. I know what the problem is, and I got the answer. Let me tell you. All those other steps, just filler in there. Things to keep you busy so you can listen to me, you know. Because the deal is, we get to step 3, and we tell folks, you know, if you do this step, your life's going to change. And we go, oh, wait. There's been a little miscommunication. Did you think I wanted my life to change? No. I don't want my life to change. You think me, Al-Anon course. It's not that bad. I just want to fix him, and then I'll be okay. Should I quit telling this story? I'm getting tired of it, but here it comes. We're like people in a lake of liquid when you're up to about here. Oh, it's not very pleasant, but it's familiar. It's ours. We know how, we've been there as it's been rising, you know, and we sort of adjusted and readjusted and maladjusted as we've gone along. And some days you have to stand a little higher on your tiptoes, you know, so you don't get suffocated by it. And these people come along in a boat and they say, you don't have to live like that, and we can show you the way out. And we go, oh, no, that's okay. I just want you to keep that guy over there from making waves. Yeah, I don't like that story. The only thing that guy can kick up is my stuff, and I don't like that whole idea right there. But that's when we leave. In my little group, when we read the introduction every time at every meeting, and we do this in the beginning of the meeting, at every meeting we say, we keep the focus on us and not on the alcoholic. Keep the focus on us and not on the alcoholic. Because it is not natural for us. We have to be reminded at every meeting. It's like you hear that and you go, oh, I forgot. Keep the focus on me. I'm the alcoholic. Keep the focus on me. That is so easy. No, keep the focus on me. And we say solution-oriented, and we talk about, we share our own experience, strength, and hope. We don't tell his story. You know, we do the whole thing. Every once in a while, somebody wants to tell an old war story about what happened the last time old George got drunk and passed out, and she poured fingernail polish into one of his open orifices someplace. And the next morning when old George woke up, he looked down and went, oh, my God, and he's been sober ever since, you know. And you watch the newcomer in the room go, oh. She got what she came for, which was something she hadn't thought of. You know, she went, well, try that one, and you got to pray for the George in her life. And if that sounds like a good plan to you, let me tell you, it does not work. The absolute last people to get them sober are us. We're the absolute last ones. We're the last ones they're going to listen to. I've seen alcoholics trip over a crack in the sidewalk and get sober. And I've seen plenty of other ones just die rather than get sober. So that's not a good plan. Al-Anon is really not even a program for people who want it, because we get a lot of people come into our meetings, come in as newcomers, miserable. Nothing is more painful than living in active alcoholism, I cannot imagine. And they'll come to our meetings. Sometimes they're encouraged by our laughter, and sometimes they're repelled by it. Alcoholism isn't funny. It's a deadly disease. And whether you're the person in the family who's feeling the responsibility for the whole weight of this deal on your shoulders, it just isn't funny. There is very few funny things. Can't remember the last time you laughed. If you hear people laughing about stuff today that you don't think is funny, you keep coming back. Because you can't laugh about something that hasn't been healed. And if it's been healed for one of us, it can be healed for all of us. When my little group first formed, we meet at the same place that an alcoholic group meets, and after one of our first few meetings, the doors came open, and their alcoholic standing on the other side like this. They said, we want to know what you were laughing at. They thought we were laughing at them. We didn't think they were that funny. Anyway, Al-Anon really is just a program for people who are willing to work at it. Just like Virgil said, it requires effort. It requires constant effort. I won't tell you it requires consistent effort because I don't know where I can be consistent, but I can be constant at it, and that's what it requires. When I got to Al-Anon, they said I had to quit declaring people as alcoholic. I'm very, very good at it. As a matter of fact, when I was fairly new in the program, I was a single parent, and I had my best girlfriend was in the program, and she was a single parent, and we were trying to find a way to earn some money, you know, some extra money, and that was about the time that book came out, like, What Color Is Your Parachute? Remember that? And if you find the thing your heart leads you to, the money will fall out of the sky or something, you know. So she and I are like, well, what could we do? What could we do? What are we really good at? Oh, I know. So we opened a little business called, well, we wanted to, open a little business called Drunkbusters. And for a small fee, if you were dating somebody and you weren't sure whether they were alcoholic or not, for a small fee, we'd go out with them. And if afterwards we thought they were the cutest thing since sliced bread, you'd know if they didn't have a sobriety chip, they needed one. Our sponsor wouldn't let us do it, but she's big on no. Just no. They said I had to quit diagnosing people as alcoholics, but they said, sweetheart, they walk like a duck and they swim like a duck and they quack like a duck. You need to treat them like a duck. You've been letting other people dictate reality to you your whole life, and it's time you started living in your own world. I think I have been drawn to the sound of quacking my whole life. If I don't hear quacking, I go hunting it. Quacking is like mother's milk to me. I just needed a good dose of alcoholism. I love open AA speakers. I just loved Mike. Was excellent. He was just excellent. I felt totally fired up, and I got my dose of alcoholism right there. Anyway, I grew up in a family where there was a lot of drinking that went on, and when I was 17, Mama diagnosed me, and the place Mama sent me to be safe was Lubbock, Texas, because she thought that I would be safe from the boys there if I was in some desert area or something. She had very little knowledge of her daughter, apparently. And Lubbock is where the very first Al-Anon meeting in the entire state of Texas was held. You know why? Because it's a dry area. They tell them they can't drink. Of course, nothing will make them drink faster than telling them they can't. And the good news for a hunter like I was then is you know what, where they are. They're right on the outside of town at the liquor store. That's where they are. You just drive by and pick him out if you want to. Well, it took me 6 months to find him. I was always looking for him. It took me 6 months to find him. And he was married to somebody else and had two kids and was 60 pounds overweight. But none of that seemed insurmountable to me. I really have never liked the easy ones. You know, I don't like the ones who say, oh, you're so cute. Can I have a date? No! Do it for me! I want those ones you have to fight for! No. Those ones who have to make love you! And I could do it. In my heyday, I could do it. And then I'd go, I have my trophy! And as often as mine, I'd go, huh. Is that it? Next, I was always like Baskin Robbins, you know, now serving 78. We were married 6 months when he hit me the first time. He was drunk when he hit me. He was drunk every time he hit me. I didn't grow up in a family where adults hit each other, so the reaction I had to him was not anything anybody taught me. I thought of it all by myself. In this fabulous place between my ears where I come up with all my fabulous solutions. I discovered that the problems in my life are not really the problems in my life. The problems in my life are the solutions I come up with for what I think are the problems in my life. I get in more trouble with the solutions than I ever would have, but I just let the problem unfold, you know. The best idea I could come up with was to double dog dare him to do it again. Made perfect sense at the time. You know, I'd been in Al-Anon a couple of years before I could equate insanity with sticking your face into this idiot. you know, in his arm length and going,
oh, yeah!
And it didn't take any more insanity on his part to hit me the second part, the second time than it did the first time. For some length of time, we rocked on, and I continued to volunteer for that abuse. And at some point, I crossed the line. And I went from the volunteer to the victim. I don't know when it happened, but I know as a result of working steps today, I know how it happened. Every time he hit me and I believed what he said, which was, I deserved that. Every time he hit me and I believed what he said, which was, if I hadn't done what I did, he wouldn't have to do what he did. Every time he hit me and I got up the next morning and I looked in the mirror, had a black eye or a swollen nose or a cut lip, and I said to myself, it's not that bad. I'll just stay in the house another day or another day and nobody will know. Every time I did that, a piece left and another piece and another piece and another piece. Until 9 years later, there was nobody left who could stand up and say, you can't treat me like that. I'm a sticker. I will get in that bed and I will damn near die in that. Apparently, my life has to be threatened before I will leave those situations. I left him after a particularly nasty bout where he held me repeatedly under a cabin cruiser in 20 feet of water. And when I shared that with my sponsor eventually, she said, honey, that's not called hitting. That's called attempted murder. But I have this, it's not that bad thing that I cope life with, you know. The reason I left him was because somebody else came along who said, you don't have to live like that, and I love you. The magic words, I've now been at it. Activate all systems. It's a go. Alligators look like the most self-sufficient people on the planet. We are, boy, you know, we're great in an office situation, in a job situation. We will come in early. We will stay late. We will work while we eat. We will not eat while we work. We will come in on the weekends. We will take it home with us. We will lie. We will cheat. We will steal. But my God, we will make you look good. We will do four people's jobs because they're not doing them right. I don't. Give them to me. We might complain about it, but give them to me. And we do the, you know, it's nasty work, but someone's got to do it, and by God, we just do it. And I look like the most self-sufficient person in the world at my job, but there's a sign on my desk that said, Wonder Woman works here. Because I had created quite the Ellen-sized position there, you know. They could not live without me. And it was where I ran away to. You know, I ran away from home on a daily basis to that place. And My sponsor said, you have to chase your fears to their root cause. And I called her one time and I said, I'm really afraid. And she said, what are you afraid of? And I said, do I need to know that? I'm thinking it's pretty good to know I'm afraid. She said, no, it's really helpful if you know what you're afraid of. Okay. And see, the deal is I'm so scared and I'm afraid of being afraid. And I will do anything to keep myself from feeling that fear. And when I would get that scared, when I would feel the fear, she would say, I'll stay with you while you work through it. She didn't, even if it was just on the phone, as long as there was somebody there, I knew I wasn't going to fall off the edge, or at least if I did, she'd know where I was and she'd come get me, you know. So we worked through that, and what I got to is I was afraid he was going to leave me. And I was afraid he was going to leave me, and then I was afraid I was going to be all by myself if he left me. And then if I'm all by myself, my real fear was that I wouldn't be enough to take care of myself. The little kid fear, that I can't take care of myself. And then underneath that is yet a worse fear, which is he's going to leave me, I'm going to have to take care of myself, and I can't. I'll just die, and there's no God. This is it. That was my bottom line fear, was that separation between me and God. I recognize that today. And when somebody said, I love you to me, what I heard was, I will take care of you. I won't leave you. So, you would have loved him too, because he was, I already knew what mistakes I'd made the first time, and I had this great list, you know. And he'd just check him off, check, 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 right height, right age, right job, right education, right family. Perfect. Except for one tiny little flaw. He didn't come home nights. I'm thinking a couple of home-cooked meals in the little, you know, when I got him. That's the way I marked my territory back then when I gave a rat's rear about it. Anyway, took me a year. That's pretty much my hunting stretch of the year. And I got him. Oh, lucky, lucky me, you know. And for a while, things rocked on. He was coming home every night, so I was pretty sure I was doing everything right. Because, you know, that's why I come home, is because I'm doing everything right. And then the night came that he didn't come home. Oh, I realize now that that bar drinker is a whole subset of drunk, you know. And I had a bar drinker. The night came, he didn't come home. I lay on the floor of the bathroom and I cried because I was pretty sure he'd seen the 2 pounds I gained, and that's why he didn't love me anymore, and that's why he wasn't coming home. And then I said, stupid, stupid me, this morning when he said, what's for dinner? I said, roast beef. Everybody knows pork chops are his favorite thing. And from now on, every time he asks me what's for dinner, I'm always going to say pork chops. And then I decided I just needed to go sit on the sofa and wait. Now, if you are training for Al-Anon, you must pass graduate waiting. And the way that you know you're in graduate waiting is if when you are waiting, you can do nothing else. You can't talk on the phone, you can't watch TV, you can't wash the clothes, you can't cook a meal, you can't read a book. The kids would come up and they go, Mom, and I go, I can't talk to you, I'm waiting. And that's because while I was waiting, I was listening. And I was listening for the sound of those tires. There are 40 bazillion other tires on the planet. I don't care about them. But I know those tires. And I can pick them out a block or 10 away. I have a spiritual, emotional, physical disease. Actually, it's a spiritual disease. If I can't work it out spiritually, the next place it works out is emotionally. And I try to make it all work out with you. And if I can't work it out emotionally with you, the next thing you know, I get sick. I get physically ill. And I have a physical, emotional, spiritual reaction when I get my fix. And my fix was the sound of those tires. I would hear those tires and I'd go, easier. It's like I've heard alcoholics talk about their first drink, ease and comfort. It's all okay now. He's home. My next thought may be, I'm killing him when he walks in the door. But at least he'll die in his own bed. And then, you know, my brain does what my brain does when it gets in those kind of places. He came home. I've discovered that they always come home. It may be that day or the next day or 3 years later, but 99 times out of 100, they come home. And I met him at the door like a three-year-old who's been crying all afternoon, and you said, stop it. You know, I've got that, you know, place, you know, with the big swollen eyes and the snot flinging everywhere, you know, and I think to myself, no wonder he drank. You know, if that's waiting for me at home, I'll just have another. Okay. And I asked the second stupidest question we ever asked. The stupidest, of course, is, have you been drinking? The second stupidest is, where have you been? Because, see, my mind already knew the answer to that question. Obsession is all-out warfare on powerlessness. The more powerless I feel, the more obsessed I get. I might get obsessed about the thing I'm powerless, and I might kick out another thing altogether. I'm an equal opportunity obsessor. I might get obsessed about my children are yours, my job are yours, my husband are yours. Not so much yours anymore. I already decided in my brain, because I'm so powerless over this thing, my brain had already figured the whole thing out, and it already had him in a ditch bleeding someplace. He was dying. That's how you know it's obsession, is if in your mind somebody dies. It is now obsession. I thought it was love. No, that's obsession. And when he came home, and I said, where have you been? Truly the only acceptable answer was in a ditch bleeding. Anything else was going to hurt my feelings, you know? And he said, well, you knew where I was. Well, of course I knew where he was. He only went three places, you know. He was at home, at work, or in the track room drinking. But see, I have the ability to hold opposing thoughts in my head, and they never touch. And the two thoughts were, number one, he loves me more than anything in the world. And remember, my life depended on that one. And number two, he's in the track room drinking. But if this one is true, this one can't be true. And in my diseasiness, I would rather wish him dead than know the truth. And he said, yeah, that thing here about as crazy as your mother. And then he said, I don't know why I stay married to you. And I said, I'm sorry. What's the matter with this picture? He's 3 hours late and drunk, and I'm the one standing at the door apologizing. I have an addiction to mind-altering men. Actually, it's not limited to men, I've discovered. And they don't even have to want to, other people don't even have to want to alter my brain. I just do it all for them, you know. Anyway, we rocked on. We're out at work. There's a lady at my work who had a child at our school, and she scared me. She was a very angry lady, and I didn't like angry people. Angry people scared me. I thought, even after I'd been in Al-Anon a while, that that was because angry people reminded me of alcoholics. I didn't know what they were going to do next, and I always need to know what you're going to do next. Don't you know? I say so that I can just be prepared. What I mean is so I can be in control. Anyway, I think if an Al-Anon had written a big book, it would have said, lack of control, that was my dilemma. Not so sure it isn't just semantics, you know. Anyway, she called school one day and she was crying. If you want to watch the alarms go off with an alligator, let her be there when somebody is crying. The primary alligator illusion is when you're okay, then I'll be okay. And I'll do everything in my power to make you okay. I will lie, I will cheat, I will steal. I'll go places I don't want to go with people I don't want to go with. I'll eat when I'm not hungry and won't eat when I am. I'll stay up late when I'm tired and I'll go to bed when I'm not. I'll sit up all night in the hospital with your sick mother when I don't like hospitals and I sure don't like your mother. But I'll do it. And it looks very loving and kind on the outside, and it's the most self-centered behavior on the planet. I don't do it because I care for you. I do it because I need a certain response back from you. And if I don't get it, I'll just try harder. Okay, well, I'll just do it on Tuesdays then, okay? Okay, well, I'll serve pork chops when I do it, okay? It used to be I'd take my clothes off. Don't do that anymore. I'm a little afraid of the reaction I get. I think it might have the opposite reaction these days. Anyway. We have a deal in my Al-Anon room. We have lots and lots of Kleenexes in our meeting room. Al-Anon, I rarely go to a meeting where somebody doesn't cry. Somebody cries at just about every Al-Anon meeting. If nothing else, out of relief, somebody cries. What we do in our group when somebody starts crying is we do not shove the Kleenexes at them. It's a very subtle way of saying, I've noticed your tears, and they must be bothering you because they're bothering me. Dry them up. It's a very subtle way of saying to somebody, I can't sit with your pain. Maybe the finest thing we do for each other in Al-Anon is sit with each other's pain. We don't tell each other, you know, wipe that look off your face and get a better attitude, Missy, and then you can come back to another me. Thank God. We don't shove Kleenexes at them. Kleenexes are in arm reach. You want it, reach out and get it. You just go for it. You want to sit there with snot down your face? Okay with us. We don't care. We don't put our arms around each other when somebody starts crying and tell them everything's going to be okay. Because we don't know that. You know, what I'm supposed to tell you when I get up here is I'm supposed to tell you what I used to be like and what happened and what I'm like today, not what it used to be like and what happened and what it's like today. Because there's still plenty of times today when it sucks. What's different today is my response to what's going on. Not so much my reaction as my response to what's going on. And that's what I hopefully will be able to share with you. But anyway, I got this lady on the phone, and she's crying. And I'm deep in my diseasiness, and I will lie, and I will cheat, and I will steal. And she said, my husband is in a 12-step recovery program for alcoholism, and as part of his recovery, we're going to pay the school all the money we own, but I just need to tell you it's going to be a lot. And I said, oh, I understand. Yeah, I understand. My husband drinks too much, too. Now, let me tell you, the problem was not his drinking. I grew up in a family that acted as if there was something the matter with people who didn't drink. You should stay away from them. They're fanatics. You know, I know today that that's my selective hearing. They never said that. That was just what I heard. His drinking was not the problem. The problem was that he didn't come home nice. But see, I thought that was about me. I thought everything was about me. I thought he'd be coming home if I was a better wife. He'd be coming home if I was a better mother, if I was a better housekeeper, if I hadn't said what I said the night before, or if I'd said something different, he'd have been home. And I wasn't going to tell her that because I didn't want her to know how defective I was. I didn't know I was talking to somebody who was new in Al-Anon, and we're deadly when we're new. We don't know what the questions are, but we've got a lot of answers, and we want to share them all. She hung out. If she called me on a fairly regular basis. I lied. I told a lot of stories. I can't ever remember making up as many stories as I made to tell her about why I couldn't go to Al-Anon meetings. I even told her at one point that my grandmother was sick. I had pulled that one, you know, right out of her. Grandma, fine, but, you know, I am making stuff up now. Anyway, I ended up in a doctor's office. All I could do was cry. Deciding what shoes to put on in the morning was a major decision. I'd sit on the edge of my bed and cry about that. Finally, I ended up in a psychologist's office, and he said, I don't have your answers, and the only people who might have them are the Al-Anons. And I felt like I was coming out of the jungle with my arms up, surrendering. I landed in a nest of what I know today are winners. I landed in a nest of folks who go to more than one Al-Anon a week. I landed in a nest of folks who go to open AA meetings. I landed in a nest of folks who went to conferences, who went to birthdays, who celebrated. I, honest to God, thought the first step of the program was getting in the car, because that's what they say to me. So-and-so is doing the steps across town. We'll come by. Get in the car. There was nowhere in there where you could check off no. No, I'm not coming. Oh, you're getting in the car. My husband first was a little intimidated by the whole thing, and then he was really grateful. Because they told me to shut up. Just shut up, Bill, okay? Shut up. They gave me this cartoon, one of those old Ballard cartoons where this guy is trying to walk down this road, and there's this woman draped over the back of him, and the caption said, Gene would do anything for John except get off his back. Okay, they said, just get off his back. Just get off his back. And I landed in a nest of what I realize today are Al-Anons, real Al-Anons, not alligators. I have an Al-Anon program today because of the program I got with them. The first meeting I walked into was a big book study. The Al-Anons were reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they weren't reading it to find out about him. They were reading it to find out about themselves. It took me 42 times reading it before I quit turning corners back for him and highlighting parts for my mother. But on about the 43rd time through there, I went, oh, my God, this is me in this book. I'm an Al-Anon today, not because of those people in my life. I got to Al-Anon because of the first part of the first step, and I've stayed in here because of the second part of the first step, because of the unmanageability of my own life, because of the unmanageability of my mind, because of the unmanageability of my fear. I've stayed in Al-Anon. I'm in Al-Anon because I have a 12-step recovery program that I practice like my life depends on it. I'm convinced today of the fatal nature of my disease. Do you know who uses the insurance first in an alcoholic home? Non-alcoholics. Alcoholics have blessed moments of blackout. Not us. We are wide awake and paying attention. Few of us are taking notes. We get all sorts of stress-related diseases. I'm an Al-Anon because I have a committed meeting that I go to every week like a doctor's appointment. If you want to find me, you come Monday night at 6:15 to the Addison Al-Anon family group meeting, and that's where I'll be. And when I walk in that room, they go, wow, Alan, there you are. And I was probably in a meeting with them Saturday. And I probably talked to a couple of them that day. But that's what happens when the shipwreck is over, you know, and we have such a bond. It's another reason I love coming to these conferences, because I love to watch you all greet each other. I love to watch the love that springs up among us. I'm an Al-Anon because I have a sponsor, and I call her on a regular basis. Matter of fact, I called her yesterday, and I used to share this thing with you. My sponsor has 35 years of Al-Anon. She has a sponsor, and her sponsor has a sponsor. And she said, I'm going to tell you this very exciting thing. She said, on this date in September, these other two, her sponsor and her sponsor's sponsor, are coming to see her. She lives in Oklahoma. And she said, we want you to come up for the day and spend the day with us. Oh, nirvana. I just cannot believe what a great experience. I get to drive 3 hours up there to the middle of God knows where. Third time we went to see her, we didn't go to her house. She's been my sponsor since September of 2001. I had a sponsor for nearly 20 years who died. And I had called Nell the day before, and I said, she is about to pass, and I just need you to know that as soon as she passes, tag, you're it. And so I've been driving up to Oregon couple of times a year to see her, and one time we went up to see her, and she was going to be in a play, and she said, okay, if you don't come to my house, you're going to go to this other place. And she said, so when you get to the intersection, turn left instead of right. And I said, which intersection? Baby.
The intersection.
Don't ask how little Warwick is. There's one intersection. That's it. Anyway. Today I know that I'm an Al-Anon, and I'm so grateful there's such a thing as Al-Anon to be, because otherwise I'd be dead. I've been in Al-Anon a couple of years and got my chance at surrender. I was diagnosed in 1984 with breast cancer. There's no history of it in my family. There's, but for some reason, cancer is prevalent in alcoholic homes. Back then, when I was diagnosed with breast cancer, they gave me a 60-40 chance of living another 5 years. I have hung my life on a couple of lines out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think there may be people I was telling this kid yesterday on the plane, I said, you know, there may be people who can live life without written directions. I don't happen to be one of them. I need written directions. And one of them is nothing but nothing happens by accident in God's world. I just love that, always and never. And the other thing is the last column of the fourth step inventory that basically says, and what was your part? Which was the first time I understood that I have a part in everything that happens in my life, not just some things. I'm a helpless victim in other places. I have a part in everything that happens in my life. And I wanted to know what my part was in the cancer, because I didn't want to die. I went through the steps in a closed step study, and what I discovered was living in active alcoholism, what I do is break out in malignancies. There were studies then that said cancer was a stress-related disease. I was blessed with doctors who didn't try to tell me why I had cancer. They let me decide why I had cancer. And I don't think it's from eating bacon or drinking Diet Dr. Pepper, which I loved very much. What I knew was that the stress of living in active alcoholism makes me break out in malignancy. And so I told him for the 500th time in minutes for the first time that he couldn't stay there if he couldn't stay sober. And he couldn't stay sober, so he couldn't stay there. And he left. And if you asked him why he left, he would have told you that anyone who had to live with that crazy daughter of mine would drink too. Jeanette knows my crazy folk. And I knew she was crazy. You know, I knew she was. She was about 16 then, I think, maybe 17. And like one Saturday morning she came home. You see the pattern in my life. She should have come home the night before. She didn't, you know. She came home Saturday morning and she's like, do what they do for some kind of success rate or some kind of shit-shable, you know, weekend follow-up kind of a thing. I'm so glad you do it for the reason you do, because my daughter was one of those ones who had to go back out again. She stayed sober about a year and a half, and then she was gone. And she was back out for a couple more years. She walked back into Alcoholics Anonymous on January 29th of 1990. I had nothing to do with it, and AA had everything to do with it. Because they hadn't treated her like she was too young when she came in the first time. They didn't treat her like because she did drugs it somehow negated her alcoholism. It was easier for her to get drugs than it was to get alcohol. Didn't treat her like she hadn't suffered long enough and she needed to go back out there again. She was recognized as a fellow sufferer and she was loved. The best thing I ever did for her was get a program and get a life and get out of her way and let her do what she needs to do. She is a fine, upstanding member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when she was 3 years sober, and she got sober twice before it was ever legal for her to drink once. She introduced me a couple years ago at my birthday, and at my Al-Anon birthday, and she said to the people in the room, "I watched you love my mother. I watched you love me when I was at my most unlovable, and you loved me in the Alcoholics Anonymous." If I had been able to design the daughter I wanted the cheerleader daughter. You know, everybody's favorite. Instead, I got this one that dressed in black, with sticky hair and white makeup, and friends who did this in my house all the time. Really scary, scary people she had. Ooh, tattoos, you know, and the whole thing. And a couple of years ago at Crested Butte, at the Crested Butte Mountain Conference, I happened to be up at the podium, and I looked at the back of the room, and there was my daughter with 14 members of her home group that she had cheerleaded up there from her one trip up there the year before. I got the cheerleader daughter. I got so much more than I ever could have dreamed of. You know, if God designed it my way, we'd all lose out. Thank God that's not the way that happens. When she was sober that first time, she started hanging out with Slippery Place, and Slippery Place was with Slippery People, and I thought if she drank, I'd die. That's the way it felt. And I told her if she couldn't do certain things, she couldn't stay in my house, and she couldn't do them. And so I planned the morning to kick her out, which I did not want to do. I love my daughter. I wanted her healthy, happy, home, and whole, and she couldn't do any of that. And I planned that morning to be the morning I was leaving to go to Crested Butte to be with 600 of my closest friends, because I knew I was going to have intensive care to be able to get through that. And that was the morning she threw herself across my bed and said, "You're going to be a grandmother." She was 18 years old and pregnant and had every intention of keeping the baby. It took a couple of hours of me saying things to her that I hoped to God she didn't hear half of it, I hope, before I finally picked up the phone and called my sponsor. And my sponsor said, "Do you want her to stay?" And I said, "No, I don't want her to stay," and I felt terrible about that. She said, "Don't feel terrible about that. There's only so many bad feelings in each interchange. Those are her bad feelings. Let her have them. If you don't want her to stay, I'll stay on the phone while you tell her." And I quit hurting when she said that. I thought the pain was in making her go, but what I realized is the pain was holding on to her when it was time for her to go. And she moved out, and we went through a rocky fall, and she went around telling people what a bad mother I was because she was pregnant and I wouldn't let her live at home. And I did things like go to the Brazos Riverside Conference, and my friend Buddy Ross was taken, and I went to Buddy, and as serious as I could be, I said, "Buddy, she's pregnant at me now." Buddy, because he was just such a good guy, Buddy said, "Oh, I understand, Ellen." He said, "I really understand how that feels." And he said, "Our son's girlfriend had a baby out of wedlock, and that child has been the light of our lives. It never occurred to me I might like it. I've loved babies my whole life, and God was offering me a new baby, and I was doing the yeah, but thing." You know, my journey in Al-Anon has been the journey from yeah, but to thank you. I think the sanity offered us in step two may be nothing short of paradise, but the reason we don't get paradise is because we yeah, but. Yeah, but not this way, God. Not this child, God. Not this way, God. Not today, God. I'm telling God how he ought to be running the universe instead of going, "Oh, well, yes, this is the way it is today. Thank you, God." See, for me today, acceptance is not just tolerance. Acceptance is thank you. Thank you for everything exactly like it is. And that's my journey in Al-Anon. So I decided to say thank you. A couple months later, she called, "Mom, I know you're knitting a blue blanket, knit faster. I had a sonogram today. It's twin boy." You know those alcoholics. If one is good, let's have two. I recognize today how different my life would be if it weren't for that second baby. If all she'd had was one, you'd probably have a different speaker. But she had two. When the babies were 5 weeks old, she was staying with me, and she said, "Mom, I can't keep them, and you can have them if you want them." If you've never been loved by an Al-Anon, you do not know what you're missing. We love somewhere at a cellular level. We love you from just below your feet to just above your head. And sometimes where you walk is hallowed ground. I had fallen in love with those babies' heartbeats in the hospital. And she said, "If you want them, you can have them." I did a lot of writing. I did a lot of talking to my sponsor. and what she had been telling me for years that God wants for me, what I want for me in my heart of hearts, but I'm such an Al-Anon. I'm so afraid if I make some decision that something better is going to come along and I'm going to be stuck with the one I don't want. So I don't make any decisions. I just let life make all the decisions around me. You know, I don't make any decisions. If you want to watch something painful, watch a group of Al-Anons try to decide where to go for lunch. Oh, I don't care. Where do you want to go? Luckily, sometimes we get those double winners who walk up and go, you know, Mexican food, we're going for Mexican food. What a Mexican food. What I wanted all along. My sponsor said, here's the deal, Ellen. The deal is you walk in the direction of your dream. Where you get is God's deal. And God's promise to you is this or something better. God's not a terrorist waiting around the corner to catch your patience one more time. It's this or something better. So start off. Stick your leg out there. Start walking. Just decide what you think you might like. Walk that way. What I decided was I didn't want to be their mother. They're the children of two addicts, and I didn't like those odds. But I wanted to be their grandmother. So she moved out and gave me power of attorney, and I went to adoption agencies, and I said, I'm looking for a family that wants two babies and a grandmother. Package deal. And they said, there are no guarantees. I said, oh, yeah, there are. And there actually are some. But you can think what you want to think. We thought it would take weeks. It took months. And we finally found a family who were perfectly willing to let us stay involved with them. They let me pick the day of surrender to give the babies up because it was the hardest thing I have ever done in my life. They were not quite 5 months old. And they knew me. And they knew the sound of my voice. And they knew my son. I don't know how he and I managed the summer before his senior year with these two babies, one of whom had a serious heart problem. And he had summer school, and I had a full-time job, and somehow we managed with these babies. But they let me pick the surrender date, and I picked a date to be the day I was leaving to go to Preston View. My sponsor was going to be there, and I was going right to her lap when I got there. And we surrendered our babies that day. They turned 18 this last March. There's not been a month that I have not seen them. We have a meal together, at least a meal together every month. It used to be that in the summer when they were younger, they'd come and stay with me for a week or so, and we'd hang out together. And they come every Christmas. They come every Easter. I've always hidden their Easter eggs. I made them do it till they were 17. And this year at graduation, they didn't come for Easter this year. This year, when I went to their graduation, I took their Easter baskets in a bag. Here you go, baby. These last 2 years have been really hard on their parents. They've aged about 20 years, the two of them. I'm surprised they're still married to each other. The older one, by 30 seconds, has been in trouble with the law in school occasionally. He has a felony hanging over his head right this minute. The thing that came as a shock to him was that the rules were for everybody. He just couldn't get that part. And the other one got picked up just inside Walmart with the latest addition he was about to make to his ladies' underwear collection at home. If they just waited till he got to the other side of the door, they could have nailed him. But you know, they got him on the inside side of the door. There are a lot of holes in their walls at home where these boys have gone through the walls, and one of the boys has moved out. The other one, I don't know what it's going to take to get him out of there. I don't know what it's going to take. You know, I have a relationship with that family that I could never have dreamed of. When the boys were 18 months old, their parents called and said, guess what? We have another baby. And she's 6 months old. Her mother wants us to raise her, and she doesn't have a grandmother. Not only did I not lose the boys, I got a girl. You know, I got a granddaughter in the bargain. And Alicia comes and stays with me in the summer. And Alicia comes at Christmas and Easter. And I have a meal with Alicia. I'm her grandma. She told me one time, she said, Cameron says if it wasn't for him, you wouldn't be my grandmother. I said, you know what, baby? God went to a lot of trouble to make me your grandmother. If he couldn't have used Cameron, he'd have found somebody else to use. So don't worry about it. They say, you know, we want to talk to you about these children. We don't know anybody else who has kids like this. You're not talking about it is what it is, but when the boys left, I decided that I was going to quit dating. I didn't. I had done another inventory, and I discovered since I was 12 I had either been chasing after, catching, going with, waiting for, engaged to, married to, divorced from, engaged to, married to, divorced from, somebody. But there always been somebody. And I hear alcoholics talk about they have this great big hole inside of them. I had it right beside me. I walked with this great big hole, and I would throw people in the hole. And I'd like to tell you how special they all were, but I don't remember much of the names. And I didn't feel complete without the hole. You know what I mean? And I've seen people come into Al-Anon in a relationship, and they're willing to kick the old relationship away and start a brand new relationship. I couldn't do that. The only way I could do it was to be on my own, finally, on my own. So when I decided to quit dating, apparently God decided the same day, because it wasn't like I had to go to the front steps and go, sorry, boys, I've sworn off. just wasn't available anymore. And that pretty much leaves you with one choice, girls. I have nothing against girls. I just don't like them much. I'm just not a girly girl. You know, I shop like a man. If you don't know what you want, don't go in there. And when you find it, kill it and get out. You know, take it home. You got stuff to say to me on the phone, say it, by God, and hang up the friggin' phone. I'm a busy girl. I have things to do. And, you know, I'm just not a girly girl. But I only had, that was all that was left. And I talked to girls and I'd say, I'm going to the Brazos Riverside Conference this weekend and you're welcome to come ride with me in my great big old car. And if you need 12 pairs of shoes for a 3-day conference, personally, I can do it all in my walker shoes. But, okay, if you need more, we got lots of room, bring the shoes. Ugh. And it's only an hour and a half trip. But every time you have to pee, we'll stop the car. Just like girls, you know, you go by someplace and they go, oh, look, a bathroom, do I have to pee? Oh, yeah, I have to pee. Mm-hmm. You know, just, you know, the whole reaction thing is backwards to me. I think I could get to Canada, maybe, you know, before I really would have to go. But anyway, every time you have to pee, the only place you want to pee is McDonald's. Okay, we'll just be in McDonald's. And every time we pass a Walmart, we're going in. And that was the killer. I mean, I was the one that suckered them in, you know. We'll stop at Walmart. I now believe that there ought to be a red neon cross in the front of Walmart because I believe healing happens in the aisles of Walmart. I was healed in Dumas, Texas in the aisles of Walmart over a $5 bathing suit. I was. We laughed so hard over that thing, I thought we were going to have to call for, you know, clean up on aisle 12, clean up on aisle 12. I had to buy it. I didn't ever wear it because I just knew it would dissolve if you ever put it on, but I just had to have it. That was such a girl thing. Oh, I must have that. You know, I always wanted God to speak to me in thunder and lightning. I don't know if you can tell, but drama is my life. And God kind of rolls his eyes around and he goes, oh, precious. He says, you know, if I did that one more time, you'd miss the message and get lost in the messenger. Now, what I discovered in that time when I didn't date and when I hung out with just girls is that God speaks to me in a language I understand best, and the language I understand best is another woman. 99 times out of 100 today, when I need help, I'll ask a woman. And I discovered in that experiment that maybe the most important thing I've found out about me, and that's that I'm enough for me. Nobody has to be added to make me okay. I am enough, exactly as I am. Somebody else comes along as icing on the cake. It's already pretty well iced, if you ask me. And so then this guy asked me out, and he wasn't, was nothing like what I intended, nothing at all. I'd known him a very long time. He was not in a program. I knew him from work. He was very funny. We were not allowed to sit together in board meetings. He was a board member, and I was supposed to be taking notes, and I would, you know, my boss finally said, you are no longer allowed to sit next to him. and he asked me out, and we're married now, of course. And when I married him, they said, oh, look, you have a normal guy. You know who a normal person is? It's someone whose story you haven't heard yet. I knew he had this, he's got an eating disorder, and I don't care what your disorder is. You just need one, you know. I need something to focus on in my times of travail, you know. You just need something. You can't be too good for me. anyway, And so what happened is if he's going to hang out with me, he's going to hang out with you because you're my people. And he hung out with you, and he thought we were really probably the funniest people he'd ever heard of. But we were a little too emotional for him. And 1994 was a difficult year. I won't tell you all the stuff that happened. It was just one slam-bang thing after another. It was like my mom died. This little kid I'd been caring for a couple of years died of AIDS. And my son got married in Jamaica, which was not a bad deal. It was just a deal, and we had to be in Jamaica and blah, blah, blah. And then me and this alcoholic woman are chairing the Crested Butte Mountain Conference, 600 of our closest friends, 1,500 miles or 800 miles away from home. And by September, October, I was just stark raving idiot. And my sponsor said, written first step, I want you to write down what you're furious about and then write down just what ticks you off. So I wrote that down, and I sat at dinner with her, and I started giving her my first step. And the first thing I was powerless over was his snoring. I loved him. But I woke up in the middle of the night thinking of stories I would talk about what happened to him after I killed him dead. And the next thing I turned over was his drinking. He was not an abusive drunk. He didn't stay out late. What happened was when he came home, I'd open the door and I'd go, hello. And if I smelled alcohol, my night went to hell in a handbasket. I needed to know that people could drink and I'd be okay. That was my powerlessness. An hour later, he walked up to the podium, said he was an alcoholic, took a chip. He hadn't had a drink since then. He's coming up on 12 years this October. Best thing I ever did for him was get a program, get a life, and get out of his way. And let happen whatever was going to happen. A couple of summers after that, my son said, I guess it was the fall. My son said, Mama, we have an announcement. We're going to have a baby, and we want you to quit your job and stay home and take care of our baby. The only people who ever saw me angry were my children, and they saw me rageful. I pinned them to the wall with my rage. And here is this young man and his wife saying they want me to stay home and take care of their baby. And my husband went, oh, no, 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 no. No, oh no, we need that money I make. Of course, he made 12 times the amount of money I made. Oh, they need that little pittance I make. And I recognize financial insecurity when I see it, you know. Okay, fine. A couple of months later, my daughter called from California, and she said, Mom, we're having a baby, and we're coming home from California, and we want you to quit your job and stay home and take care of our baby. My husband, oh no, no, no. Summer comes, I'm in California. Talking and I get one more phone call from my son who says, if I tell you one more thing that happened at the daycare today, then will you quit your job and stay home and take care of our baby? And I could hear my daughter-in-law crying in the background. And about that time, Dick had been listening to some tapes on his way out to California to meet me, and he had heard some Clint H. tapes on the steps. And somebody had asked Clint, they said, Clint, exactly how much money do you have to so you won't feel financial insecurity? And he said, well, I guess just enough so I wouldn't have to trust God. My husband heard that and he went, and then I said to him, he said, okay, if you still want to do this, and then when I heard my daughter-in-law crying in the background, I said, I got to do this. We're not leaving him anything. And I don't regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it, but if I could change anything about what happened when my kids were little, it was those mornings when they said, Mom, I don't feel good. And I said, too bad, you don't have fever, go to school. Because I couldn't not go to work. I couldn't not be in my runaway place. I couldn't stay there with them during the day. And I can't change that, but what I can do is I can be here for them now. So Madison came to me in August of 1999. She was exactly, the day I got her, she was exactly the same age the twins were the day we gave them up. So I didn't miss a beat. Tristan was born in December, and Melissa, at 3 weeks, had to go back to work, so I got Tristan in early January of 2000. Kennedy was born in March of 1999. And Sutton was born in October of 1999. And I ended up with four little kids in my little business, Moms That Are Babies, Affordable Daycare for Your Priceless Children. The only people I keep are my grandkids that don't have. And it's the best job any human ever could have had. It is the absolute best. If I could have designed the job for me, I went in my pajamas to work. I slept with the people I worked with, got paid to sleep with them. My sponsor, I got the phone call that my sponsor was dying, and they said she's got 2 weeks to a month, and I said, tell her I can't come tomorrow, but I'll come the next day. I've got the kids tomorrow, but I'll be there on Saturday. I'll be there. Tell her I'm coming. Then I had to get all four of the kids in the car and get them all jammed in there because somebody had to go to the doctor, and then it was just a big, huge day, you know, and they were like 3-3-2 and infant, 3-3-1 and infant at that point. I'm jamming in the car, jamming in the car. And one of the three-year-olds reaches over and taps me on the arm, and he says, baby, it was my sponsor coming through the kid, you know. And the other three-year-old goes, "Dean, ain't nobody in here but us chickens," you know, which is exactly what my sponsor would have said. Focus on who's in front of you, you know. Focus on who's in front of you. This last August, almost a year ago, was when that job ended, and I went into really a depression. It was, I never had empty nest syndrome with my children. I changed the locks on both damn. But it's one of those circles, you know, I've gotten to experience it with these little kids. We're taking the four of them Wednesday up to Crested Butte to be with 600 of our closest friends. This is their third summer to go, these little kids, who are now 6, 7, 8, and 9. And I'm not taking them there. I'm taking them there because, number one, I love being with them. Number two, I want AA and Al-Anon to be a safe place for them. I want them to feel comfortable around us. I want them to hear the words so that one day the words will make sense to them. I can't prevent alcoholism from happening in their lives. I'd be surprised if it didn't. But maybe, just maybe, I can make a safe place for them. I used to think that when I died and went to heaven, God was going to say, pull out the VCR and the tape, and I want to see how her husband and her children turned out. And if they turned out to be fine, upstanding members of the community, she's earned her way into heaven and she can come in. I'm so grateful that you gave me the chance to find another God. I'm not sure what's going to happen when we leave this place. But the little story I've made up and my sponsor says I can have is that when this body of mine gets tired of doing whatever in the world it is we're doing here, and that little part of me that's always been God goes to wherever it is God is, when I get there, he's going to go, "Oh, there you are. Why would God greet me with less love than you do? And who else's love do you greet me with but with God's love?" And he's going to say, "You know what, precious, heaven's heaven when you're not here, but it's just not perfect without you." And then he's going to say, "You know, I've been running a little experiment down there. Nothing could pass or fail, just a little experiment. I know you've been paying close attention, so I'd like your opinion."
Of course God wants my opinion. It's my heaven. It's my story. Sure, I can have it. And he's going to say, "Here's the first thing. Did you have a good time? You know, I didn't do a single thing to torment you. Everything I did was to try to make you not just more comfortable, but to help you enjoy your life. Did you have a good time?" There was no reason for flowers to be different colors, except I thought it'd make you smile when you drove past. And I knew you loved babies, and I put a lot of them in your life, and I hope you didn't miss them. And because of you, I'm going to be able to say, "Oh, yes, I had a great time at your party, God. Thanks for asking." And the second thing he's going to say is, "Were you Ellen? You were the only one like that I made. I had things for you to do that nobody else could do. I had things for you to do that I needed you to do because my hands are too big." That one scared me because I've spent so much of my life trying to base what I do on what I think you want me to do. But I was afraid I hadn't been Ellen. I do a written inventory every night. For a couple of years, one of the lines in there was, "Today, Ellen," and I wrote down what was mine to do that day. And after a couple of years, I looked back at that, and I realized 99% of it was what you would call service work. This was mine to do today. You could have had another speaker and been done 15 minutes ago, but no, that's not what happened to you. You got me. And the last thing he's going to say is, "Baby, did you ever get the joke? You know, I got the joke the year of cancer. I got the joke standing at the back door of my house with this strange-looking body, with this hot pink neon orange daughter who was living over the edge someplace, with a beige navy blue son who was disappearing a moment at a time, sleeping more during the day, staying up all night, into more and more video games, less and less of him, more and more stuff. I had a 60-40 chance of living another 5 years. I had a husband who would ask what was for dinner, and he might not come home for 3 weeks. I had lost all the hair on my body except the gray, which was like fried nerve endings that kind of blew around on my head. And I had put a scarf on so I wouldn't offend people with my nerve endings. And I was getting ready to go out the door, and I looked down and realized I was going to have to go back and shave my legs. And that, I started laughing. I'd lost all the hair except under my arms and on my legs. And I got the joke. I could hear God rolling around the floor of heaven, you know, just clapping his hands at me. "Oh, you're the one, you're the one, but I got life, afraid of what I wasn't going to get that I thought I had to have, or afraid of what I was going to lose that I thought I had to have, that I almost missed the miracle that was right in front of me. I almost missed the miracle that is me. And that's what you've given me. The guy in my group says the glass isn't too big. The glass isn't half full or half empty. Glass is just too big. Bill Cosby says the glass is either half full or half empty, depending on whether you're drinking or pouring. What you allow me to do when you listen to me is you allow me to pour. The miracle of how this works is that when we walk out of here, I'm the one whose cup overflows. And I thank you.